AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Richard Lawson. Katie Rich is on vacation this week, but she's making Rebecca and David work. We have David Canfield.
Hello.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
So obviously we're going to have to talk about Barbenheimer. We're going to do that first. It's the story of the year in movies, pretty much. And then after that, we're going to look ahead. The lineups for the Toronto Film Festival and the Venice Film Festival have been announced, which also helps us figure out through secret means what will be at Telluride, which is between those two festivals. So I think we should start with the big dual box office narratives of the summer, which, you know, of course, is Theater Camp and The Miracle Club coming out on the same day. No, of course, Barbenheimer, whatever you're calling it, has happened. We have witnessed its mighty awesomeness, just as the boys of Los Alamos did. I think it went better than expected, even. I mean, we were thinking it was going to go well, but this feels like pretty watershed for this year, or really this decade.
For sure.
What do we think the big takeaway is, like, for you guys? Like, are you feeling really optimistic about what this says about the future of movies?
I am. I mean, I think that they're both really original visions. And, like, while Barbie is a very IP-driven product, I do think that the movie built really organically on the strength of a marketing campaign that emphasized that it was distinctive and weird and driven by a filmmaker who has made a lot of great movies. And I'd like to think that was a big reason why it blew up in the way it did, along with the memeing and everything else. It seemed to create a kind of perfect storm. And Oppenheimer, you know, there's really no other way to sell that movie, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like the narrative started out about these two films competing against each other. But what really happened is they, like, supported each other, you know, like people went to see either one. And I saw some stat that like 6% of people who saw Oppenheimer, it's because Barbie was sold out or something. And you're just like, oh, so these films sort of worked together to make this even a bigger success. Whereas the narrative originally was like, you know, they're competing. And it's like, no, we can have two nice things at once.
Packaging is a dirty word in Hollywood, but this is a good kind of packaging. Like, I like the idea that maybe two films can kind of help each other in a given weekend. I wrote a piece about it that's on the site now. Basically, there were a lot of people saying, oh my God, this is like huge for the future of movies. This is going to save movies, like they said about Top Gun and other things. And then people pushing back against that, saying, well, Barbie's IP and Oppenheimer is a biopic, so it's kind of IP too. So let's not, you know, count our chickens yet. I think it's somewhere in the middle. I think that it's great in the short term. We'll see what the long-term effects are. Maybe it's just more toy movies and Christopher Nolan gets another blank check. But the way, like exactly like you said, Rebecca, it evolved from Barbie versus Oppenheimer to Barbie and Oppenheimer. I think to me indicates maybe nothing about studio behavior, but certainly audience behavior, that people are hungry for this kind of event. And yes, we've had singular events like Top Gun and Avatar, but this felt different because it was about going to the movies, not necessarily going to a movie. It was like, I want to experience whatever people are talking about this weekend, and I can choose between the two, or I don't choose. And to me, if I were in Hollywood making these kind of decisions, I would say, well, obviously the interest is there, even if our boardrooms and our shareholders are more intractable about this stuff.
Yeah, I really hope that, you know, we all know that Mattel is sort of has this plan to do a lot more films with their toys. And I really hope they are consistently going with interesting filmmakers, because I don't think we need a bunch of sort of standard fare toy movies. But if they can find, you know, other filmmakers who have something interesting, you know, to say, or a way to play with these stories, I'm actually much more optimistic than I was when I first heard that that was the plan moving forward.
But just to your point, Richard, about Top Gun Maverick, like, there is this mounting evidence that movies that actually have some level of originality and vision behind them are the ones that resonate. I mean, I even think of something like John Wick 4. Like, if you compare the trajectories of movies like those, and now Barbie and Oppenheimer, to like The Flash or Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, it to me, there's a cumulative effect of these are the movies that, when marketed right, when resonating in a certain way, obviously it's never a slam dunk, that do take off and that do resonate. And I think there's a definite lesson to be learned there that I find a lot of hope and optimism in.
Even if it's just shaking the industry out of the superhero fog, you know, and saying, yes, we're still going to have franchises. We're going to have the fourth John Wick, the second Top Gun, Avatars 3, 4, 5. Like, those franchises have a lot more freshness to them than does Marvel 30 movies in at this point, or DC, however many, you know, movies in. And I think that's so instructive to look at the reaction, because it's like, yes, Barbie is IP. Oppenheimer is a biopic about a very famous person. Like, these are not totally, wholly original, out of the blue kind of things. And yet they are different from the status quo. And that's enough to move the needle in a huge way, like much bigger than I had anticipated, in terms of box office numbers. We should also talk, as this is, we're less of a box office podcast and more of an awards podcast.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, I think that that clearly both of these movies, I think, have now solidified themselves in Oscar narratives. I mean, it might sound silly to say that about Barbie, but I don't think it looks that silly now at this point. Do you guys agree?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that in the case of Barbie, it is quite tied to box office, actually. So it does make sense to lead with that, because it's a phenomenon. And as we saw with Top Gun just last year, a movie that I don't think was by any means a Best Picture Oscar contender when it was first screened, as much as critics liked it, Barbie gets by on the strength of its word of mouth. And I'm not sure if that's going to translate to a Best Picture nomination. But the fact that we can talk about that, we can talk about its adapted screenplay, we can talk about, I think, both Margot Robbie and especially Ryan Gosling in the acting categories, and the craft on that movie is just unbelievable. I mean, when you put all that together, that's an across-the-board contender that could very well emerge with, like, honestly, a leading nominations total, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I think it really has the narrative all set up for it. I mean, if you kind of have to acknowledge that, you know, comedies don't have the easiest path to Oscars. But I mean, this movie has a lot to say, and we have seen that films that sort of have those deeper messages have been doing really well in the last few years. And, you know, Noah Baumbach, who co-wrote the screenplay with Greta Gerwig, they both have a ton of nominations for screenplay. I think that's a very serious place it'll contend. Original song, I'm Just Ken, is just coming for that, I hope. I hope that's what they submit for it. Because
I would expect so.
Yeah, I feel like it's a serious contender. And I don't know if they went into it, you know, Warner Brothers sort of had that hope, but I think now that we'll be talking about it for a long time, and this is a weekend that, you know, will be in everyone's memory for many, many, I don't know, years to come, I feel like it definitely, they both are very serious contenders. I guess we should talk about Oppenheimer, who is the more traditional awards contender, especially being what was more of a biopic than I expected. But I think performance-wise, Cillian Murphy and Robert Downey Jr. both deserve to definitely be in that conversation and lead and supporting.
Yeah, I could see Emily Blunt sneaking in there too for supporting. She has one kind of bigger scene that plays really well. Well, it's funny talking about Downey Jr. because Oppenheimer is like a supporting actor movie. I mean, there's so many men in this movie of various levels of renown, but all pretty known, you know, maybe more niche like Benny Safdie, but you have like the glorious ongoing return of Josh Hartnett. And like, there's just so many people all the way down. And yet they could all be beaten by Ryan Gosling.
100%.
Like quite easily, I think. Or would they run Gosling and lead?
No, I think he'll run
supporting. I think he'll be supporting.
He's Ken. He's supporting Barbie, literally.
Yeah, yeah. Although his performance, I feel like, has popped maybe a little bit more than Barbie's own. But but no, I mean, the Oppenheimer thing is interesting because I thought that I would walk out of that movie feeling a little more circumspect about its Oscar chances. Maybe that was just summer bias or something like that. But like, that movie really is aiming for that sort of attention. I don't know that Nolan went in being like, this is my Oscar movie, but like every frame of it, every bit of craft, every performance feels engineered to be a big, slightly throwback studio Oscar epic. And I feel like it delivers on that. And I think people will remember it.
Yeah. I think he could win Best Director for this very easily. It feels like if the right narrative builds, this could be his year because it is such an achievement. And the level of filmmaking on display, he's never won for subtlety in that department, is very obvious and very complex and very well served to this story. Yeah, I think that the case of this movie is because it is such a traditionally strong Oscar contender, as we've seen the Academy shift and move around in recent years, like I wonder how far that will get it, because there are reasons to think that, not that a movie like Barbie is more likely to win Best Picture necessarily, but that in an era of preferential ballot, in an era of a rapidly changing Academy, there are reasons to maybe not overshoot on its chances, but to also be confident that while I said that Barbie could be a nominations leader, like this movie, I would say almost definitely will be one of the top nominations getters of the day, just based on the amount that it can go for.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it really surprised me that Nolan has only been nominated for the directing Oscar once before for Dunkirk. I had sort of assumed in my mind it'd been a bunch of times. I mean, he is such an incredible director. He's had a couple screenplay nominations, but it does feel like, I think you're right, that he could really be a front runner in that category at least.
It's weird that he's in some way had a more compact, or I guess, no, I guess they were sort of on the same timeline, but like him and Spielberg, you know, it went from like, oh, he's the big populist director, but with some serious impulses. And then he has to push through that. And with Dunkirk, his war movie, you know, like Spielberg had his war movies. And then there's a second World War II movie. And that worked for Spielberg, for Schindler, obviously, and Saving Private Ryan. And it didn't work for Nolan with Dunkirk. But like, yeah, maybe this is the one that finally has that narrative click into place. And we can stop, you know, or the Nolan acolytes can stop bellyaching about it. I mean, I don't think he doesn't deserve it for this. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of what's to come, and we're going to get into that with the festival talk, but like, it's a real feat of direction. You know, I think maybe sometimes there are places in Oppenheimer where the screenplay is struggling to catch up to the pace of the direction, but it's such a cohesive, enveloping vision. And on the sort of more cynical economic side, he tricked a bunch of people to go see an IMAX movie where it's just people talking in rooms and there's one distant explosion, you know, and like, well done, like you pulled it off. It's also a shame, I should say, that Katie's not here today, because Barbie is a veritable cornucopia of best song potentials, right? Like, and you think about an Oscar ceremony next March, if that is indeed when we have an Oscar ceremony, like Lizzo performing that opening Barbie number, maybe at the top of the show, would like be quite a big moment.
Yeah, that's all you need. That's all you need. I had that exact same thought.
I mean, they have to do something where they do some sort of Barbenheimer combo. I want to see Cillian Murphy dancing to the Lizzo song. Who can make that happen for me?
I believe it was on Who Weekly where they mashed up the Lizzo song from Barbie, and I think kind of the signature motif from the Goranson score for Oppenheimer. And they actually kind of match up. Like it's kind of a good mashup. So maybe they could do something like that. And then we could have a more contemplative moment later in the ceremony of Billie Eilish performing that song from the more poignant ending of the movie of Barbie. Yeah, I mean, they could just basically do the whole Barbie soundtrack during the Oscars, and I think people would be very happy.
Who needs the rest of the fall movies? We figured it out for you.
What, is Maestro going to have an original song? I don't think so. That guy's dead.
Never say never, Richard.
It's true. Actually, honestly, in these days of holograms and AI and de-aging and whatever, they could probably bring Bernstein back to write a song.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Well, is that a good point maybe to get into the fall festival announcements, which Toronto announced on Monday, Venice very early in the morning US time on Tuesday. We were all nervous. David, you wrote something about the Toronto lineup where, you know, a day before the Venice came out, and there was, you know, you were a bit worried maybe in the writing about like whether Venice would get big titles because of the strikes. I feel like, and I had that worry. I was, you know, I've been ready to cancel the trip if need be. I feel like I'm feeling more sanguine about Venice. We'll start with there because that's where Maestro is going to be, because it's a pretty starry lineup, at least director wise.
I was feeling that same nervousness about the Venice lineup. But when I wrote it up this morning, I realized I was already having severe FOMO that you're going to be there, Richard, which is my general test for if it's going to be a good lineup. And it feels really, really big to me. And it does not feel like it has been hurt by, studios pulling their films because of the questions about the strike still going on at that time, which it very likely will be. But I mean, we have new films from a ton of directors and a lot that I think we have already been anticipating. It's Sofia Coppola, David Fincher, Ava DuVernay, Bradley Cooper, Michael Mann. I mean, and then a few films that I actually didn't see coming for this year. So I think it looks really great.
I also think you have a case here of studios standing by the festival a bit more than maybe we expected. My pessimism was rooted in challengers leaving that opening day slot and then moving to 2024. It seemed plausible that other movies would follow that path, but you see a movie like Poor Things, the Yorgos Lanthimos film with Emma Stone, which had a very clearly intended rollout of Venice premiere, very closely followed by an early September release. They kept the Venice premiere. Emma Stone, as of now, will not be able to go. Searchlight is owned by Disney. There's no way that would happen. But then the release date was moved to December. So they did, you know, react to the strike in the way that they had to, but they did maintain that premiere with a filmmaker who's done very well at Venice in the past. I think there are some movies that were probably effective. I don't think they're the top, you know, titles to think about here. Like, definitely Maestro was near the top of our list of, you know, will this movie show up, as was The Killer. So Netflix is really, really well represented here. I think also in the TIFF lineup, we saw a lot of Telluride premieres, and we didn't have as many last year. And one interesting dynamic going into September will be a big group of Venice films followed by a big group of Telluride films that don't necessarily overlap as much as they sometimes do.
which is great for our coverage.
Yes, selfishly. It's kind of ideal.
You know, I know that obviously there are a number of the bigger films on the Venice list, Maestro included, where, yeah, technically Bradley Cooper is also a director, so he could go promote the movie in Venice just as a director, but he's also in it, and like I wrote it, I think, and so like I don't think that he probably will not go, is my guess. But you have some other things that are still for sale or are independent, you know, from distributors who are not in this cabal of producers and studios involved in the strike. So we might still get some famous faces on the carpet, or it's just actors with like beauty deals, you know, fashion deals, and they are not there yeah. promoting a movie. They're just there promoting themselves, essentially, and that's above board, right?
Yeah, I think it is. So.
I also don't know about, like, does Bradley Cooper go? I don't think that's known yet. You know, Greta Gerwig has continued to promote Barbie, but she's, while she is in SAG, she's not an actor in the film. Bradley Cooper is a lead in Maestro, so that's where it's going to get fuzzy.
And it's like, could you really do a thing where you're like, Bradley, we'll sit down for an interview in Venice, but you can only ask him about the direction of the movie. You cannot ask him about playing Leonard Bernstein. Like, I just don't think that works. And and regardless of even if a journalist and a publicist find a way to thread that needle, the optics of it from even one or two layers removed from just people reading that content, like, it seems like Bradley Cooper's breaking a strike, you know? And I think that they definitely want to stay away from those sort of accusations.
It is impressive that they have successfully made a lineup with enough giant director names that maybe we won't be quite as bummed that we're not seeing, you know, Emma Stone and Michael Fassbender and all these actors on the, like, it'll still feel like, I think every day we'll see pictures or read interviews that are feel exciting just because they have so many massive directors coming. But my eyebrows did raise when I realized that Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, and Luc Besson all have films in this lineup. This feels like a very canned move of Venice, and I'm not sure what to think about that other than that this is how the Europeans do it.
Yeah, I've already seen some people who were like, you know, Cannes putting the Johnny Depp movie as opening night, and then Venice being like, hold my beer. Like, here's three films, one of which is in competition from, let's say, very controversial directors for various reasons. And you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. I don't know that the Woody Allen, which is his first French language movie premiering out of competition, that doesn't, or the Polanski movie either. Those don't feel like must-sees, but I know that, like, you know, the Luc Besson movie being in competition, like, a lot of people are going to have to cover that because they have to cover all the competition films. And yeah, I guess that does make for a murky festival, but a controversial festival, which is cynically kind of sometimes what you want.
I guess they will bring star power in their own way.
Headlines, for sure. Headlines.
Headlines are good. I mean, I don't really want to see like Woody Allen spit on Luc Besson. That's not as fun as what happened last year. But you know, you never know. Maybe there'll be some sort of bad director's brawl at a party on the Grand Canal. Well, let's move over to Toronto because that is another story of directors taking center stage over actors, except in Toronto's case, a lot of those directors are known mostly for being actors. So can you, David, because you wrote the sort of rundown, tell us some of the famous actors who are making either directorial debuts or their next films that are premiering at Toronto.
Sure. Tony Goldwyn has a film with Rose Byrne and Bobby Cannavale and Robert De Niro. Michael Keaton has made a crime thriller called Knox Goes Away. Kristin Scott Thomas has what sounds like a lovely movie called North Star. You have Chris Pine's directorial debut called Pool Man, Anna Kendrick's directorial debut called Women of the Hour. And then I would say on the more established side, Viggo Mortensen and Ethan Hawke are back with new films. And based on the language of Hawke's movie Wildcat, which stars his daughter Maya Hawke, that one will also probably go to Telluride. So that's your group. I don't know if the best way to put it is that TIFF lucked out, but these are stars who will go to the festival and show up presumably in a pretty big way for their movies. And that's in addition to a pretty robust slate of acquisition titles and things like that. So, you know, I mean, who knows how these movies will turn out or whether any of them will be able to figure into an awards conversation. Certainly possible. You know, these are, for the most part, really good actors and people, I think, with good taste. And Ethan Hawke is certainly someone who's proven his bona fides, behind the camera. But I'm just I'm still a little unsure of what this tiff is going to look like, because, you know, you do have a lot of movies here that where those premieres are not going to look like what they would have looked like a month or two ago. And that remains the case.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't the Toronto lineup as is. It feels a few like big, you know, Knives Out or Fablemans. A few of those short of a you know, huge Toronto, but there's hopefully enough star power and enough movies directed by famous actors, and those movies are not part of Struck Studios, so people can actually go promote them. Like, it feels like there will be enough to talk about, and I don't know. I see some awards things lurking. I mean, we've talked previously on the pod about NIAID, like Annette Bening getting another run at Oscar, which I think is pretty exciting. You have Kate Winslet in a biopic of a war photographer called Lee. So I don't know. I see some bright sort of perhaps the glints of awards in there. Rebecca, what jumped out to you in the Toronto lineup?
Well, I think it's impressive they got a couple world premieres, even though they're the last in the lineup of the festival gamut. So they have Dumb Money, which is the Craig Gillespie GameStop movie. And then they have Next Goal Wins, which is Taika Waititi's film, which I feel like both could be awards contenders and could play very well at that festival. They feel like the audience will really like those types of movies. So I'm interested to see how they do, you know. And then they also have this movie Pain Hustlers with Emily Blunt and Chris Evans. So I'm curious about that one, though we haven't heard much about it. But yeah, I think it's really smart that they have so many sales titles that do have the possibility of more promotion by actors at the festival, though we still don't know that for sure. But that does seem like sort of a lucky break for the festival.
Craig Gillespie's last movie, awardsy movie he did direct Cruella, was I, Tonya, and that was obviously a huge success out of Toronto. It sold, it got Allison Janney an Oscar and Margot Robbie a nomination. So that, you know, that Dumb Money is one where he's a director who I'm not necessarily the audience for his movies, but he does tend to resonate in a particular way with the industry. So I did definitely catch that one. And to your point about NIAID, Richard, you know, there are a lot of Telluride premieres here that very well may be going into Toronto with a lot of buzz. Presumed Telluride premieres, I should say. Telluride, of course, does not announce until their Labor Day weekend festival. But that, Rustin, The Holdovers, Alexander Payne's film with Paul Giamatti and Divine Joy Randolph, these are all, you know, described in such a way that we can assume they're going to Telluride. They also feel like Telluride movies. There's also Apple's Fingernails, which is a movie we haven't heard much about, but it's got a really phenomenal cast. Jesse Buckley, Riz Ahmed, Jeremy Allen White, and that seems to be going on a pretty robust awards route as well. So there's a lot to be excited about, and there's a lot, as always with Toronto, to keep your eye out for what movies are going to be going into Canada with a certain level of excitement already built in from the previous premiere.
Yeah. Do you know if Fingernails, does that have distribution or is that a sales title?
It's Apple.
Oh, it's Apple. Sorry, you said that. So they are being struck, Apple, correct? So we won't get like hottie Jeremy Allen White photos on King Street in Toronto.
Hottie Jeremy Allen White and hottie Riz Ahmed.
Oh, right. Yes, right. Yes, yes, yes. So that's reason enough for people to go back to the table and really figure this thing out. Yeah, I think also I this is just top of mind for me because I happened to finally catch it this week. But I finally saw Anatomy. I mean, finally, it's not out for months, but I got to see Anatomy of a Fall, the Palme d'Or winner from Cannes that Rebecca saw a while ago. And I was really blown away by it. And I believe that's going to be a Telluride, we're thinking, and Toronto. And it's very good. And Sandra Hüller is amazing. And I mean, this sounds horrible to say, but like to the movie's benefit, there's a lot of it in English. Mm-hmm. And I really think that like she is one that we should all keep our eyes on. She didn't win the Best Actress at Cannes, presumably because the whole movie won Palme d'Or and they wanted to spread the wealth. But I think it's an incredible performance. And there is usually one or two, quote unquote, foreign slots in the main acting categories. And I would hope that she would be recognized for that.
Know that fizzy feeling you get when you read something really good, watch the movie everyone's been talking about, or catch the show the internet can't get over? At the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we chase that feeling 5 times a week. We talk about the buzziest movies, TV, music, books, and more. From lowbrow to highbrow to in between, catch the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
So in general, obviously, we can trust that the performers and writers involved in these festival films, Venice, Toronto, Telluride, are going to stick strong to the union rules. I know there has been talk about certain special dispensation made for people based on, you know, what movie is in what distributor or whatever. But so we'll see how that plays out. But I'm curious if you, either of you, have any thoughts on how the studios are going to be treated. I mean, like, is seeing a Netflix logo before a movie going to elicit boos at this festival like it did one year at Cannes? Or, you know, is there going to be all that circumspection about streaming movies at this festival at a time when streamers are kind of turned to as one of the chief, you know, architects of the downfall of the industry? Like, from, you're both based in LA, like, what do you think that mood will be as people try to launch campaigns for these movies that depend on a lot of consistent adoration, and maybe people are feeling reluctant to do that these days?
What a tough question, Richard. I feel like you may be the expert on this, because I feel like if there's any of that sort of drama at the festivals, it would be at Venice. Because now that you've reminded me about the Don't Worry, Darling drama of last year, it just feels like that is, you know, like Cannes, that is the festival where drama is sort of part of the package. You know, Telluride is so laid back, and a lot of those studio execs do attend, and I think can just kind of watch the movies. There aren't press conferences or those types of red carpets. So where David and I are, we'll be a little more relaxed. But I do feel like it'll be, how can we predict the mood, you know, in a month and a half from now, when we imagine that these people have been striking for that long at that point, and how much fear there might be, you know, by the time the festivals are here? I just don't know. But it is a good question, because what will be the topics of those press conferences in Toronto, you know, and Venice, when this is the biggest thing affecting the industry in years? So I don't know. It could be a tough one.
The discrepancy between the fact that these are the big studios who are being struck against and what the actual movies are, you know, these really personal, often small, independent visions, will, I think, make it a challenge for the mood to get too negative, for lack of a better way of putting it. I mean, you're really talking about, like, if you go back to a movie like Naiad, you're talking about what may be a really wonderful narrative for Annette Bening. And that's going to be the story of that movie, not necessarily that it's a Netflix movie. So I'm just not sure that we're going to hear that much sentiment around it unless there is a concerted effort on the part of actors and writers to make sure that is known. And so as we talk about this question of who can promote what and who, you know, who should do what, I think that that might be the more pressing question, is who should do what. Because to your point, Richard, maybe Bradley Cooper can technically go to Venice and participate in a press conference and sit for interviews as a director. But the bigger question is, what role does he play in that as a member of that guild that is on strike? And I think that that's a really individual situation. And depending on how a bunch of individuals react to it, especially, you know, those Toronto filmmakers we're talking about who are actors, you might have a collective kind of mood that does inform something that's a little bit more tense, and maybe appropriately tense.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it'll be an opportunity for these conversations to be had in these settings that are so focused on the work, you know, and like, hopefully directors will speak up about this stuff. And you know, I don't know, I'd be interested to see if maybe some of those executives you mentioned, Rebecca, don't make it to Telluride this year. Out of some sort of, I don't know, these people don't experience shame. What am I talking about? But lastly, before we close out, I'm curious if there are some movies we're not seeing on this list. We don't see Blitz. We don't see Napoleon. We don't see Dune 2, which, you know, obviously the first one premiered at Venice and played again in Toronto. Do we read anything out of that? Or is it just these are big studio or big movies, and maybe Blitz isn't done yet, but like, they don't need this particular runway?
I think word on the street is Blitz is not, we're not getting Blitz this year, okay. But I don't know if that's confirmed, but I think we were all, that was my Oscar pick for, you know, Best Picture winner in that episode we do. So I guess I'm out of the running already. Oh, well. So we were all sort of hoping that one was going to make it. But I feel like from the calls we've been making, David and I and Katie, there's a lot of conversations going on about strategy with backup plans if the strike is going till October, November, December, who knows. But it feels like, does Dune 2 need a festival debut this year after the success of the first one? I don't know. So I think a lot of it is just strategic choices on depending on the studio's decisions this year, because I think they all look at what does a festival give us and does this film need it this time around?
It does feel like with the larger scale movies that there has been a concerted choice to not make these festivals. I thought of Ridley Scott's Napoleon as well as The Color Purple, movies that are dated for November and December that don't need this necessarily. And that now, really, I would say, have very little reason to do a festival premiere. But I am looking at a movie like Saltburn that was pretty heavily rumored to, I think, hit Venice. It's not going to Venice or Toronto. It certainly still could go to Telluride. We have no way of knowing at this point. But though there are still movies like that where it's like, has a bigger decision been made, or is the rollout going to be a little bit more careful, a little bit more gradual? And that's a very wait and see situation.
And you would have thought that they would have wanted to trot out Emerald Fennell so hot off of playing poor, maligned, pregnant Midge in Barbie. Although she's a writer on Saltburn. So maybe, you know, that would be a conflict.
She's a SAG actor. Is she? Yeah. That's another one of those tricky situations. I don't think she's in Saltburn, but it's still tricky for her.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I'm confident that a festival can still feel robust and exciting without a lot of the on-camera talent. But I say that as someone who will be there watching the movies and writing about them in a critical capacity. I wonder what the attention will be outside of that. You know, if people are really going to be eager to see coverage and, you know, red carpet photos of David Fincher. You know, I don't know. That feels maybe like a steep climb. But we will have all that coverage in the coming weeks. We're very excited about that. In the meantime, you can read David's write-up of the Toronto lineup, Rebecca's write-up of the Venice lineup, my kind of pseudo Melanie analysis of Barbenheimer from this past weekend, all that and more on VF.com. Well, that does it for this week's episode. As ever, you can find us at VF Awards Insider on Twitter. You can email us at littlegoldmen@vf.com if you have any questions about Barbenheimer or fall festivals. You can find me once again for the time being on Twitter at Rylaws. Rebecca
M. Ford.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs. And this week's award for what we've been saying about producer Brett ever since he started goes to Rebecca Ford.
He's Ken.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.